Blog Talk Radio.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to mini episode number 175 of the FDH Lounge. This is FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris here today. We've got a very, very, very special one for you here on the program where nothing is off topic and befitting something like the 175th mini episode. Very, very happy that we can dip back into the well over at CBS, which has been very good to us previously, along the lines of Bob Barker and Rebecca Jarvis. We've got another one of their big key people over there. And, again, a gentleman who has covered so many different things over the course of being an investigative journalist, both with CBS News and CBS Sports, as well as over at HBO as well. I speak, of course, of the one and only Armin Katan. A true pleasure to welcome him to the show. Armin, good to have you on today, sir. How are you?
I'm good, Rick. I'm in my car headed home, so if I have to put my phone down for a second, it's not because I don't want to speak with you. It's only because I'm trying not to get a cell phone ticket here. So please indulge me if I drop out for a second or two.
Oh, no problem. No problem. Thank you so much for being able to come on with us today. I guess I'll start with that, you're there in New York and checking out the U.S. Open this week. And, again, a lot of the big media storylines over a period of time, obviously with Rafa being out on the men's side, that's an absence that's felt, but you've got Murray trying to climb up to the top level with the remaining big boys. You've got a lot of great players on the women's side, and it really seems like every tournament, every big one seems to yield another one coming forth. What have been some of the biggest storylines that you've seen in the course of the U.S. Open this year?
Well, I actually went out there last night, and I got to see Murray play for the first time in person, and he pretty much dismantled the 118th ranked player in the world from Croatia, who actually was a very, very good player. But Murray was just like a human backboard. It was incredibly just very, very facile, very quick on his feet. And, you know, when you see this kind of tennis up close, you realize that the shot-making skills, and not just the power, but it's just the pure shot-making skills are so unique. They remind me, or they're actually unlike any other sport I've ever seen. So Murray, obviously, and you have Federer, and you have I saw Djokovic play earlier in the week, and he just, you know, basically just powered his way by his opponent in a blink of an eye. So the other person that I saw last night was Sharapova, who ranked number 3 going into the tournament, and she looked fabulous as well. Fabulous, and I guess in a couple of different ways. I mean, she was just you know, not only, you know, stylish on the court, but really stylish in her game. She seems incredibly focused. And so it was just, it's just one of those great New York events. You know, the Open at night is special. It was a gorgeous night. And, you know, the place was packed. And I just think you're going to see whoever ends up, whether it's, you know, whether it's Venus or whether it's Roger or whether it's Djokovic or Murray makes his way to the finals, perhaps, you're just going to have a classic New York event.
Yeah, it sounds like it is going to be epic, and I agree with you completely on Maria, by the way. Yeah, when her game is on, she's definitely bringing satisfaction to the fans in two different ways. But as far as it goes with Murray, I mean, I know it's a small sample size in the tournament thus far, but based on what you saw, I mean, you sound pretty impressed with his performance last night. Are you just getting the vibe watching him that Olympic win might really mean something, that he's stepping up in class to the big three?
I think so. You know, I mean, I think he won 3-2, 3-1, and 2, and you know, it was just an overpowering performance. And as I said, you know, his opponent played really well and played hard. He just wasn't able to win any really big points at all. And you know, I think the matter of confidence at this level, when you're in the top 3 or 4 in the world, and it's basically Rafa, you know, Federer, Djokovic, and Murray now that have separated themselves from the men, at least excuse me, on the men's side, that, you know, it's just one of those things where I think if Murray can just kind of get a sense that he belongs there rather than he's just sort of an interloper in that in a big event like the U.S. Open, you know, I think it makes a big difference whether he can beat Djokovic, you know, on this kind of surface remains to be seen. But, you know, it's just going to be tremendous tennis one way or the other.
Well, and it's really interesting, Armin, because whatever happens with him, it could really undermine the case that a lot of people have been making for the other prominent Andy in the men's game, the great American hope all these years, Andy Roddick. And there's been a sense over the last year or so, which to me kind of looks like revisionism, that, what are you going to do? It's the era of the big three. Nobody's going to get past these guys. But it almost seems like a zero-sum game there, doesn't it? That, I mean, if Murray makes it through, it really kind of undermines any case that Andy Roddick was just born at the wrong time.
Absolutely. I think Roddick right now is playing, you know, he's playing all right. He's just not in the same class as the big four, whether it's physically, you know, just being able to compete for five sets or just having the stylish nature of the game. I mean, they're just such tremendous shot makers that you just, you know, there's just a difference right now. And Andy in his prime was, you know, within that very small circle. But right now, I just don't see it. These guys are in a class by themselves.
Yeah, it's an incredible amount of talent and just accomplishment at that level with what those guys have been able to do, and it is probably something that's really going to stand out even a couple of decades from now. As I indicated at the top, Armin, there is, of course, so much to be able to talk about with you, given all that you've covered and a lot of the great stories. I want to thank you, by the way, for emailing us and you know, with some good ideas on things. I do want to go off the grid from that a little bit just because of something you put on Twitter this week and the story that I was able to see. And this is just fascinating to me and to anybody else who really is always wanting to understand the nuts and bolts of crime and how these things happen. We've been hearing all summer long about this huge summer of murder in Chicago, and your story ended up drawing some connections that I had never even imagined about direct cartel involvement in that and them being involved as direct players in this. So as far as structurally how this fits together, are we looking at a situation where the gangs on the ground are basically subsidiaries of them, or that it's any kind of a war in that way? I mean, that's fascinating, Armin.
You know, it's interesting, Rick. You know, in my journalism career, I think if I had to just pick one word that I go back to time and time again when I'm trying to figure out stories is why. And like so many people, I saw the escalating violence in Chicago and the murders, and I just kept saying to myself, you know, why is this happening now? And I have some contacts in the DEA, so I called a friend of mine in Washington, and I said, you know, I've read a couple things here, and there's been allusions to the drug gang violence in Chicago escalating. I said, is there a direct connection here? And he said, well, he goes, I can tell you that, but the guy you really want to talk to is this guy, Jack Riley, who's the agent in charge of the Chicago DEA office. He's a very experienced, he's been on the front lines of the drug war for years. So I called Jack up and I said, am I mistaken here? And for one of the few times, I have to tell you, I got the straightest answers I've ever received from somebody in Jack's kind of a position. He said, there's an absolute connection between the violence, the gang members, the cartels moving into Chicago, the fact that Chicago is in the middle of the country, it's a transportation hub, and it was fascinating. And then for Jack to allow us to come and really just shadow him around Chicago as he gave us a tour of some of the things that are happening there. I mean, you have, you have three major cartels that are basically carving up Chicago and have been carving up Chicago for the last few years. Most prominently, the Sinaloa cartel with Chapo Guzman, who Jack Riley said is the most dangerous man on the face of the earth. And then you have the Zetas, which is the former military group in Mexico that is ultra-violent, and they're involved in the drug trade. and then you have another Gulf cartel that's there, and then you add in the fact that Chicago has the single largest collection of gangs in the country, more than 100,000 members. So they have the soldiers on the ground capable of moving and distributing the drugs. And then Chicago being such a huge transportation hub with trains, planes, freight, interstates, you name it, to move the product into Milwaukee, Indianapolis, Detroit, St. Louis, New York. And that's where these murders are the result of. And for Jack to be so blunt about it, I just thought it was fascinating and a really smart piece, which is the kind of stuff that, you know, I like to do.
Well, yeah, it was really, really mind-blowing in terms of as a story. And, again, different people are going to take different parts from what you just said and find them to be the most interesting. For me, I'd have to say it comes down to the business side of it, if you will, because you talked about the 100,000 gang members on the street. And again, you, as I understood it over a period of time, a very fragmented scene there in Chicago. How exactly did these cartels, have you gotten far enough into it yet to see how they paired up with the local gangs on the ground and basically recruited these folks to be part of their operation?
Well, I think what happened was there were a couple of things that one, you have to go back to Chicago's location, and two, the demand for drugs in the United States is just never-ending. So if you start with the demand and then you look for the suppliers who are saying, okay, where do we bring it? If you bring it into Chicago, you can move it pretty much anywhere. The other big transportation hub is Atlanta. Number two is when they tore down the Robert Taylor housing projects in Cabrini Green, those were the homes, essentially, of a lot of the drug dealing in Chicago. And when those were torn down, the drug dealers were basically let out into the streets, and they went essentially corner by corner where the new turfs were being battled over. And then when you bring in the drugs and the cartels to take control of those streets, and oftentimes one corner over another corner, that's what we're seeing right now. You're seeing enormous violence in an age group between 20 and 24 years old, mostly African-American or Hispanic. And you're also seeing, I think, another part of the violence here is twofold. One, with this massive amount of heroin coming through Chicago, cheaper, more potent than ever. And two, Chicago really now becoming a major mecca center for cocaine distribution in the country. So all of those things kind of combine into this, what Jack Riley called this really toxic atmosphere now. And then you add one more element, which is really kind of fascinating, is that Chicago, and I did not know this, has the second largest Hispanic American community in the country behind Los Angeles. And so what that provides is a matter of deception for the gangs, because it's mostly Latino, Hispanic American, African American, but mostly the Mexican cartels are there. So you have a lot of very hardworking, legitimate Hispanic Americans who are in communities, but then the cartels can then take a storefront and mix into the community, and that becomes a distribution center for drugs. So it's very, very difficult for law enforcement to ferret out, you know, where these people are actually operating from.
Well, once again, many very interesting threads to what you just said. One thing that jumped out at me, I've never heard the tearing down of Cabrini Green as presented as anything but an unmitigated good, but clearly there was the other side to it, that the rats kind of scattering, if you will, and able to cause problems in other places. It's just fascinating because I'd never heard of it presented that way. I have to ask you, too, because you've referenced about Chicago being such a transportation hub. My natural question on that, one of our show contributors used to be a legal advisor for some trade group out of there, and I learned at the time from him that it was the biggest rail hub, I guess, in the country, or one of the biggest ones. Are you speaking of that? Are you indicating that,
absolutely,
among other things, it's making its way out on trains all over the country?
Oh, trains, planes, automobiles, freight cars, you know, you name it. The cartels are brilliant when it comes to distribution and hiding drugs, and whether it would be cars or buses or, I mean, in one freight train, I know they found 800 keys of cocaine that they made an arrest about 2 years ago. So when you have O'Hare, Midway, you have several major interstates that go north, south, east, and west. You have the trains there. You have, you know, there's water not far away. So, you know, there's all manner of means to move the drugs from that central location all over the country. And if you look at any sort of maps that have been put together by, you know, the drug assessment people, all the arrows kind of lead to Chicago and out of Chicago.
Wow, that is terrifying. We're just really to think of and all the technology that they're putting to use. They got to be using the latest high tech devices too to figure out how to do this as well, Armin.
Well, you're right, and I think what Riley said to us, which was fascinating. I mean, he spent 2 years in El Paso on the Mexican border, and he's using the techniques that he learned fighting the Mexican cartels along the Texas border. And really what he came up with is they have to use the same kind of task force, 25-agency task force, that communicate with each other on a daily basis. And you have federal prosecutors, you have state prosecutors, you have local police, you have the ATF, the FBI, every imaginable, the sheriff's department, every imaginable law enforcement agency now communicating. So if something's happening along the border, it's being communicated to people in Chicago now. If Chicago senses something, they're sending transmissions down south to say, hey, look for this guy or look for this shipment or keep an eye open for this car, because that's the only way that you're going to begin, and Jack said it, this is a marathon, not a sprint, but they're going to be able to, if not control, at least, you know, calm this violence, because it's really changed in many, many aspects of a great American city. It's completely changed the complexion of these neighborhoods.
I can imagine. Yeah, that must be very, very terrifying just to live around there these days and have all these things swirling around. And from a story that's terrifying, but you know, certainly probably a little exhilarating to cover because of all the different aspects to it, to something that is just plain soul-crushing, that being the Penn State story there. I'd like to really get your thoughts, because there have been debates that you know, some of us have had on air and off air about the situation, and you being one of the only people in the media, if not the only one perhaps, to look Mike McQuarrie in the eye and get a chance to talk to him for at least a few minutes.
Yeah.
My sense of it is I sort of have the middle ground position of I don't regard the man as a demon, but neither do I have any sympathy for him, because I would think that the bare minimum that you would do is to go break up the situation regardless of how shocked you are. What's your sense of having had to, you know, look the man in the eye, gotten a sense of how much humanity he's got or doesn't have? From that perspective, how do you come down on what he did?
Well, let me say this. I mean, I spent a very short time interviewing Mike on camera. I've spent a considerable amount of time talking to him in other forms and fashions over the last 6 months or so. And I can tell you that his life irrevocably altered by this experience. You know, he no longer lives in State College. You know, that's just not... his future there has ended. And yes, I think you can say that in a perfect world, should he have physically assaulted Sandusky in that locker room shower in February of 2001. But I would argue that he did break up a very horrifying moment there and was just so overwhelmed by what he saw that I don't think he wasn't thinking perhaps as straight as everybody can think now in the aftermath of that. I think personally that Mike McQuarrie is the only person that I ran across at Penn State that was directly involved in this case that stepped forward and stepped out of the bubble there to take a courageous step on behalf of those young boys. from Graham Spanier to Tim Curley to Gary Schultz to Joe Paterno, my sense is that the overriding factor in all of it, and it was mentioned time and time again in the Free Report, was protecting the culture and protecting the brand of Penn State, even at the expense of you know, probably dozens of young men's lives at this point in time. So, to me, Mike McQuarrie is I don't want to go as so far as saying a hero in this story, but he is certainly, to me, the one individual who put the young men's lives ahead of everything else. And I don't think you can say that, despite the revisionist history now, Spanier and others, that I don't think he's the only one that was directly involved that can say that.
Okay, well, I'm glad to hear that. I mean, that makes me feel a little bit better about him. I'm glad to get that perspective from you. From having looked at the situation and reported on it.
Let me go back with you for a second. Imagine growing up in State College, going to State College High School, knowing Jerry Sandusky's sons, being the starting quarterback your senior year at Penn State, having a successful career, being brought on as a grad assistant, married with a young child, and really living the dream of being part of a iconic program in your hometown, and then on a night where you're inspired by a movie after watching Rudy, you go into your office thinking you're just going to put your new set of sneakers away and watch a little game film and of recruits, and you walk into a locker and you see something that in your wildest dreams you could never imagine. And in between 45 and 50 seconds, you are faced with a series of scenes and choices that are unimaginable, you know, a half an hour earlier. And Mike did, and I was in the courtroom when he testified in the Schultz and Curley preliminary hearing, and I was in the courtroom again when he testified at Sandusky's trial. And for people to say that he somehow didn't make it clear to people that this was a sexual assault is ludicrous from Joe Paterno on down. And I just think that is simply deception on the part of the other people. I believe Mike McQuarrie, and more importantly, the grand jury believed Mike McQuarrie, and more importantly, the jury believed Mike McQuarrie. So for those that say, well, why didn't Louis Free interview Mike McQuarrie? Mike McQuarrie clearly, under oath, no less than three different times, explained his story, and he explained it twice in public. And for those that somehow say, well, the Free Report is a distortion of the facts, or it's somehow slanted or biased, I find it appalling at this point in time that Penn State could still be, some members of Penn State, whether it's a board of trustee or other members of that community, could still consider it that this somehow didn't happen in some way, shape, or form.
It's utterly incomprehensible, no question about that. At the same time, as we're here on the eve of another college football season, having covered programs like this extensively, as you have, certainly the Penn State situation and seen a number of these other ones up front, everybody's saying all the right things right now about a culture that can allow a man like Joe Paterno to become a king and be above the law. But when you look around at places, when you look at Urban Meyer consolidating power at Ohio State, Brady Hoke at Michigan, now that it looks like Lane Kiffin's got USC turned around, do you get any sense that anything's really changed, or that there's just a lot of lip service at the moment about football can never be bigger than the institution ever again?
I think football right now is bigger. If you take the mega programs, and I mean Alabama, LSU, Auburn, Michigan, Ohio State, USC, Florida, you might want to add in a couple other ones there, Florida State on its way. they're all bigger than the university. The athletic department and the football program now, particularly the football program, is the engine that drives the entire university. It certainly drives the entire athletic department. I mean, you have football programs now that are responsible for generating and are generating north of $100 million every football year. And they are the absolute engine that drives every other sport in those athletic departments. And people like Nick Saban and Lane Kiffin and Urban Meyer and Les Miles and Gene Chizik and Brady Hoke, they're kings. They're kings in their community. They're paid like kings, and they have the pressure of a king. And I just think what we're seeing now is just another seismic shift in college sport with these conference realignments, the massive regional television deals, and obviously the upcoming playoff system. The face of college football right now is changing before our eyes, and it's changing further away from any kind of definition of equal definition of the word student athlete.
Absolutely, much less the word amateur being involved in that as well. By the way, Armin, I just got handed this by one of our show members, Kyle Ross. Breaking news, to go back to our earlier conversation here, Andy Roddick to retire after the U.S. Open. So in light of what we talked about him previously in this conversation, and we don't know why at this point. I'm guessing it's not injury-related, but thoughts just right off the top of your head, first thoughts on Andy Roddick and his legacy.
He's a great player. You know, I mean, I don't know the tennis history as well as you probably do, Rick, but I mean, certainly in his prime, he was a great American tennis player and, a champion. And I think that good for Andy, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, this sport is built on young legs and a young life, and he's got probably neither one of those right now, but he's got a beautiful wife and he's got, a wonderful, prestigious tennis career, and good for him for not hanging around and getting bounced out of first round matches. So let him go out in style. He goes out in New York and, I think it's probably a bittersweet day for a lot of people in the tennis world, but good for Andy.
Yeah, definitely. And again, the man is married to Brooklyn Decker, so lest we weep too much for what he didn't accomplish on the court.
Yeah, how bad can life possibly be, right?
Yeah, I think life found a way to even everything out for him, Armin. But as far as some of the other main stories that we really haven't touched on, or any of the big topics that you've been covering for HBO, CBS, what haven't we talked about yet today, Armin, that you're covering right now that you find to be most compelling?
Well, I think I'm just watching this Lance thing. I mean, I covered 5 tours for CBS, and there's another one of those stories that is deeply political. There's so many different things going on right now with Lance and this and USADA's stripping of his 7 tour titles. And I think it's important for people to know and remember that United States Anti-Doping Agency is not a government agency, and it bills itself as a quasi-government agency, but it's a private nonprofit organization whose job it is to implement a drug testing program on behalf of the Olympics and on sport in the United States. So what they're searching for, and by their own mission, is true sport. And I think that Lance, given the fact that he's been investigated by the French authorities, he's been the subject of 2 or 3 major investigative books, a 2-year investigation by the U.S. Attorney's Office out of California and Los Angeles. People always ask me, they say, well, did he cheat? My answer is I don't know. But what I do know is, outside of one drug test that was suspicious back in 1999, Lance will argue he's never failed a drug test in more than 500 drug tests. I think that's pretty impressive. Now, knowing what I know about the Tour de France and the fact that virtually everybody that ever stood on a podium with Lance Armstrong, from the time he first won the tour till the time he retired, has been implicated in a doping scandal or voluntarily removed himself from the sport as part of a drug investigation, people can draw their own conclusions. But whatever was happening in the Tour de France, it was a level playing field. And Lance Armstrong, beyond whatever was happening pharmacology-wise within his body or members of the U.S. Postal Service, was by far, had the greatest will, had the finest precision techniques, trained harder, and was part of a machine that had one goal in mind. So when Lance said, you know, and you listen to these other people that he competed against, nobody is standing up and saying, oh, I should have been the tour champion because Lance cheated. This is as much as anything else, to me, is a political situation where a anti-doping agency is attempting to establish its powers by going after an athlete who's been retired for 7 years. I don't frankly get it, but you know, if they think that their message that they can strip Lance Armstrong of 7 tour titles is going to somehow mitigate drug use among elite athletes, well then, you know, good for them, because you can go back to Balco, you can go back to Roger Clemens, but you certainly can go back to Balco, where the government spent untold millions of dollars to go after Victor Conti and Barry Bonds and you name it. And what they ended up with was pretty much bupkis at the end of about 6 years worth of investigations and grand jury.
Well, that's a really intriguing perspective on Lance, and one that's definitely underrepresented in the media. But
yeah,
you said something about, you used the word politics in there. And I think back, and this is what always made me laugh at the time, the politics of it and what the sentiment was in this country about France, freedom fries and all of that. Lance's his defense at the time always seemed very cynical to me. Just, you can't trust French people. He never really offered a substantive critique of why they were coming after him like they were. Is that something you find curious?
Well, Lance, I mean, look, Lance sees boogeymen around every single corner. I mean, he is one of the most, you know, you don't want to get on Lance's wrong side. So when the French went after him, I mean, clearly I was there. There was a tremendous anti-Lance Armstrong sentiment for a time because, frankly, Lance was kicking everybody's ass, particularly the Frenchman's ass, that were, you know, it's their sport. Imagine somebody coming to the United States and beating the New York Yankees in the World Series from France. And just imagine what the sentiment would be like in the Bronx toward, you know, toward that team. So part of it was that. Part of it was Lance's arrogance. Part of it was the fact that he was larger than life, I think, because of his surviving cancer. And he was a target for a lot of people. I've known Lance since 1995, and I've covered him, you know, in 5 tours, and I consider him to be one of the greatest athletes I've ever had the privilege of watching. And to see it up close day after day in the tour, where one day they're riding 135 miles over 4 or 5 mountaintops that are beyond category in the climbs, to believe that a human could do that again the next day with simple glucose and aspirin is to shred the bounds of credibility. So I just find that USADA has a big dog in this fight regarding the politics of this, much like other French anti-doping agencies did as well. There's messages being sent here, not only from Lance's camp, but from Travis Tigard and USADA. So to think this is just some clean, we want to clean up the sport effort by USADA is to be naive to the fact that the Olympic drug testing is a very, very, it is rife with politics.
Absolutely. Yeah, they're all the way around when you start getting into the drug testing. I think that's something we can all agree about. And Armin, as I knew would be the case, anytime we get talking about the stories of the day with you, inevitably we're only scratching the surface because there are so many things we could be talking about with you. So a true, true pleasure to have you on today, sir. We'd love to do it again. Thank you so much for coming on with us.
It was very, very enjoyable, Rick. I got to tell you, I really did enjoy it. Thanks a lot for having me on, and good luck with the show.
Thank you so much, Armin. Appreciate it. And thank you all for tuning in today. Mini episode 175 of the FDH Lounge with Armin Katayan.